Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
A regular guest on this show, we always enjoy his expertise, is Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul. Mike, welcome back. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well, and a happy Friday to you, John.
There's a few things we want to cover, minimum wage among them, but let's start with the big picture. Debate about whether or not cutting the corporate tax rate, which was passed by the Trump administration, has had a net negative or positive impact on our economy. If we don't tax the corporations as much, what's the theory behind that? How is that supposed to work, Michael?
Well, you know, there's two... Economists are divided on the corporate tax. Corporations, of course, in the Constitution are considered persons, so to speak, and therefore they should pay taxes. And that's why a corporate tax exists, because corporations earn money and they should pay what a lot of people call their fair share. But, you know, Milton Friedman pointed out many, many years ago that corporations don't actually pay taxes. They remit taxes. They send tax money to the federal government. But the actual payment of the tax comes in the form of you and I paying more for the product that the producer produces. They simply pass on the tax to you and me the way they do the cost of electricity and any other input. So some people would argue that the corporate tax rate should be zero. And then you and I, in terms of the dividends and profits that are earned, you and I should pay the taxes, not the corporation itself. But that battle was lost decades ago. So then we have to decide what is the proper tax that corporations should pay. And of course, what happens is we get competition between countries. If a multinational can locate in any country at once, it may go to the country that has the lowest corporate tax rate. So that's why you'll see countries around the world kind of competing with each other by lowering taxes. So it turned out that during the Trump administration, the U.S. had one of the higher corporate income tax marginal tax rates in the world. And Mr. Trump was able to convince Congress and even some Democrats that it would be a good idea to cut that rate. Now, that was met with two reactions. One, it's unfair because corporations aren't paying their fair share. And the other one saying, but it could be that these tax cuts will do good. So some economists did was they looked at every tax cut for corporations going back to 1950 and asked the question, what is the behavior of the firms in the years after these taxes are cut? And they found two things, depending upon the kind of corporation you are. If you're a service-producing company, it turns out that the extra tax, the money that they didn't have to pay in taxes, they gave back to the owners in the form of dividends. So in some sense, they took the money and ran. However, we have to remember that when dividends are paid to the owners,
pay taxes. Pardon me. They took the money and ran. They gave it back to the shareholders of those companies rather than lowering the cost to everybody
else.
That's
exactly right. Yeah. Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. Yes, that's exactly what they did. They gave the money not to the consumers. They didn't lower the price. They gave the extra profit, so to speak, to the owners of the company.
In the service.
Now, it would be,
I guess,
nice if they would have put it, you know, maybe cut the price some, but the finding was they didn't. But we must remember that when you and I receive dividends, you know, we have retirement funds and things like that, we pay taxes on those dividends. And so it's not as though that money gets off scot-free. It is taxed when it finally comes to you and me. But the interesting thing was that when you look at goods-producing companies, these companies use that extra money to do exactly what we would hope they would do, and that is invest in new capital and in new workers and pay their workers more. So this particular study, like it went from 1950 to 2006 as, you know, what evidence do we have that the Trump tax cut might do good? They found that, in fact, that the companies would invest more in capital, which would make them more productive. They gave more money to workers, and they expanded their workforce. Now, in the long run, the good side of that is it would increase what we call productivity, output per hour, which would make the corporation more efficient and the economy more efficient and the workers richer. So if the past is any guide, there should be over the next couple of years some very good outcomes from this corporate tax cut Mr. Trump put through a couple of years ago.
Have we seen those benefits yet? I thought the federal revenues were off and that we are not seeing a similar or even greater return. The idea being that they pay fewer taxes, but then they generate more income, and that's good for everybody. But we're not seeing that. We're upside down on the tax cuts right now, I thought I read that.
It could be that. What I have read, of course, is, we talked about this, I think, the last time I was on when we were discussing, do we have a spending problem or an income problem for the federal government? The percent of GDP brought in by the government in the form of tax revenues, tax receipts, as they call them, is the highest on record. So the government is taking in a lot of money. Now, exactly how much of that is the corporate tax, which, by the way, is only about 10% of the total tax take of the federal government. 90% of it comes from payroll taxes and other kinds of taxes. It's a small part of the tax revenue of the federal government. It's not the major piece. But if we get increases in productivity, I think maybe that's a positive instead of a negative, because that's actually what drives advancement. Workers become richer when they become more productive, because they can demand higher wages that in response to their higher productivity. So if a firm does buy more capital and the worker works with that better capital, the worker can demand higher wages because they are more productive. And that's good for the firm, and that's good for the worker.
I just wanted to read to you a paragraph that I saw a couple of weeks ago from Heather Cox Richardson, who has a decidedly different take on politics and the economy than you do. But she talked about the growing debt, and she said, why is there growing debt? Previously in this column, she wrote about the New Deal. She gave us a historic perspective on taxes and spending. Anyway, she writes, why is there growing debt? Because tax revenues have plummeted. Tax cuts under George Bush and the Trump administration are responsible for 57% of the increase in the ratio of debt to the economy, 90% if you exclude the emergency expenditures for the pandemic. The United States is nowhere close to the average tax burden of the 38 other nations in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, all of which are market-oriented democracies. And those cuts have gone primarily to the wealthy and corporations. Republicans who back those tax cuts now insist the only way to deal with growing debt is to get rid of government-regulated business, provide a basic social safety net, promote infrastructure, and eventually promote civil rights, all elements that stabilize the nation. Anyway, she goes on. But I guess two points about there. One is, did the tax cuts not return that amount of money to us? And number two, it's kind of we get to decide whatever the corporate tax rate should be. So what should it be? And in other countries, the corporate tax rate is higher. What do you want to say about any or all of that, Michael?
Wow, that's a lot. I'll tell you this. One way of looking at tax revenues is for the government is as a percent of gross domestic product. And with all those tax cuts you're talking about, we still have the highest percent of GDP of tax revenue taken in by the federal government since forever. And the government does not have a revenue problem. Government, in terms of having such a large debt, is because of a spending problem. We're spending on things that we didn't used to spend on, and we're doing it involving more and more dollars. And one other thing, I understand that compared to some other countries, the U.S. has a smaller government. That is correct. But you want to keep in mind a couple of things. One is that in most of the other countries, they have larger welfare states, which means they have a lot of spending and a lot of revenue taken in by the government. But the taxes paid by the middle class and lower classes are considerably larger than what we do in the U.S. The United States has the most progressive taxation process in the world in terms of, do our rich people pay a large percent of all the tax revenue of the federal government? And compared to other countries, our rich pay more of the total tax bill than any other country. Because you'll see that, for example, if you look at just the income taxes taken in by the federal government, the top 50% of wage earners pay 98% of all income taxes. The bottom 50% pay 2%. In countries of the OECD, that is not the case. In those countries, people that we would call middle class, who maybe pay a 15% marginal rate here in the U.S., would be paying 40 or 45% marginal rates in those countries, something that's never been the case in the U.S. It would take a complete change in the tax base for us to spend or to have that kind of revenue come into the U.S.
I understood that to be the case, that the bottom 50% don't pay nearly as much into our tax revenue as the top 50%. But is that a tax problem or a wage and income problem?
That's a tax problem because
you can't ask people who don't have much money to pay money they don't have.
At the very bottom. But you see, in a lot of other countries, for example, in Europe, with large welfare states, people in what we would call the middle class do pay considerably more in taxes than middle class in the U.S. So, I mean, somebody making, I think I saw a number, it was comparing Ireland to the United States. And let's take an American and an Irishman who are making, say, $50,000 in terms of income. The amount of income tax paid to the federal government by the two is considerably different. The Irish pay much, much more in taxes than the people in the United States do in terms of that income level. So there certainly could be larger revenues taken in by the federal government, but it would require a change in the tax base. In other words, the number and breadth of people who are paying large numbers of dollars in taxes. That's what the data show us. They absolutely show us that is the case. We are very progressive in the U.S. when it comes to our tax structure.
Michael, you lined up three different topics for us to talk about today, and we've only gotten to one because I wanted you to drill down on some of this. I appreciate your patience with me here. We'll tackle those other topics another day. Fair enough?
That sounds great, Sean. Anytime. I enjoy this very much.
I always do. That's Mike Miller, and he is a professor of economics at DePaul. Christopher Zara is a senior editor at Fast Company and the author of Uneducated, a new memoir about navigating the professional white-collar world without a college degree. He's joined us before, and he joins us again. Christopher, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me on.
I know a little bit about your story. Maybe some of our listeners do, too, but now there's a memoir out that sort of tells your story. Give me the elevator pitch. What's that Uneducated memoir about?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. So, you know, I work in an industry, journalism, the news business, where you typically need a college degree to even get your foot in the door. It wasn't always the case that the news business was so highly educated, but of course it is today. And my own experience sort of breaking into it as an unpaid intern years ago, I felt that there was this perspective that I had as someone without the college degree and working among so many people who were so highly educated, not just college degrees, but oftentimes from Ivy League schools and really, you know, top tier schools that many of my colleagues have attended and gone to. So I thought there was, you know, I really thought there was a story to be told about people like myself, not just people who work in highly educated fields, but people who kind of go through life without traditional education. I think there's a case to be made that education is really a defining characteristic for all of us, whether we have it or not, that it sort of helps shape our identities. And that was the story I wanted to tell. And I received a lot of really positive feedback from people who just either didn't go to school, or maybe their kids didn't go to school, or they didn't go to the right school. And it just feels like something that a lot of folks can really relate to.
I think they are now as well. And I think the idea that you don't have to have a college degree for certain jobs is especially resonant. But how is it that, and we'll get to that in a second, but how is it that you weren't able to get a college degree?
So I delve into it in the book a little bit. I mean, there's a whole backstory of my high school experience. I went to a very overcrowded public high school in New Jersey. They didn't have a lot of time for kids with I'll use the word special needs because that was the word they used. I had some behavioral problems that kind of stuck me into the special education system. Actually, this still goes on today with a lot of children who get labeled emotionally disturbed and kind of stuck in these special schools. So that's what happened in my case, and I didn't last very long there. There was a lot of violence and a lot of checked out teachers who didn't seem to really care, and eventually I got thrown out in 11th grade. And you know, from there, your path is often set in life when you start there. And for in my case, I spent a lot of years working menial jobs in retail and jobs that I didn't really like, you know, and scooping ice cream and things like that, until eventually I decided I was going to come to New York and try something different. And that's where I found the internship opportunity. A lot of luck happened after that. Some of it was determination, but a lot was also luck. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time where I was offered jobs in the business. And from there, you know, that's kind of where we are now.
Sure. Just one last thing about your biography. It relates to what we're talking about anyway, but was there a pivot point in your life? Was there a moment, a conversation, a meeting? Is there some singular thing you think your life turned on?
Yeah, I do. I think there was a point when I was probably about in my early 30s, and I realized that this is it. Like, this is your life. Your life is either going to be this, where you're working at the shopping mall, or you're scooping out ice cream, or you're building picture frames, another job I did, or you can change it. And so I decided, I was in Seattle at that time, I decided I'm going to change it and come to New York and go to New York City, and that's what I did. And there was some opportunities that presented themselves when I showed up, but it was really a combination of just realizing that at 32 or 33, however old I was, like, life was not going to change unless I made it change.
Let's talk a little bit about the dependence of reliance on college degrees.
Yeah.
What's happening in the private sector and the public sector out there right now?
Well, the conversation is changing a lot. There is a movement now to do away with degree requirements for a lot of what might be called middle skills jobs. You know, jobs that didn't used to require a college degree. I think what's happened is over the last like four decades, a lot of jobs that now require this college-level education didn't used to, and so there is no pipeline from high school directly into the workforce without college. It's really difficult, and companies now are in a pinch. They need workers, and I think not only do they realize the system is unfair, but they're doing it for self-serving reasons because they need people to fill these roles.
Yeah, it's unfair, I guess, to some potentially good employees, but it would behoove them, and it might have behooved them all along, to be a little more liberal in deciding who they're going to hire. I guess we use a college degree, regardless of how well it trains you for the next job, we use it as evidence that you have the stick-to-itiveness, that you are going to be a disciplined person. So if nothing else, college does that. Is that one of the reasons we've been reliant on degrees?
That's actually correct, and I think that there's been some pretty good research on this. Harvard did a whole thing about what they call degree inflation. The degree is used as a proxy for someone's ability, for someone's grit, for someone's determination, and it could mean that. It could also not mean that, but when that degree is the only signal that people have, we become, I think, the business community becomes overly reliant on that one signal, and so everything else gets filtered out. And in the case where you don't, if if you could be a great worker and have tons of experience, but not have the degree, and you might not even be able to get your resume seen.
But if you got good grades in college, it tells me you're smart too, that you can solve problems, that you can, that you have the mental chops that I need for this job. I can rely on you. Now, what do you make of that kind of evaluation?
Well, I think that that's true. And I also think that, like, having the degree is always going to be an advantage in our society. I think the argument I would make against that is that if that's the only signal you're using to evaluate a candidate,
right,
then you're going to wind up with a certain type of worker, homogenous type of worker, and a homogenous type of workforce. So I would say that yes, please use that signal. You know, evaluate someone based on their grades. If you need someone who's going to be in that kind of work where good grades actually help them. But if that's the only signal that a company is using, I think it shuts a lot of people out unfairly.
Well, I like the kind of guy who said, you know what, I'm 30, I'm in a place that I don't like. Talk about initiative. I'm going to drive across the country, throw my hat in the ring, and by golly, I'm going to make something of this now. That's something, too. It's just hard to quantify that. Talk to me about companies then that are actually doing what you and I are talking about, not relying on a college degree. Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a bunch. I think I mentioned, you know, Google, IBM, Delta Airlines, GM. Those are just some really well-known companies that have done this. Now, they're not eliminating degrees for every single role, but I think they're really looking at which roles might not necessarily require the college degree, and what they're doing instead is looking at skills. Now, how they measure skills, that does become a little bit trickier, and I think if you ask every one of those companies, they're going to give you a different answer. But there's a lot of really smart people, I think, doing the work of trying to figure out how do we evaluate candidates beyond the traditional educational attainment, because we do want a workforce not only that reflects the broader world, but that can do the job that we want them to do. And as we just mentioned, grit and determination as two factors that we want in a worker, I think there are companies trying to figure out how to measure that beyond just looking at the school that appears on their resume.
Many agencies across the country, more than half of the states, are taking a different look now at the competencies mm-hmm. of people and not making it just dependent upon a college degree. Christopher Zara is a senior editor at Fast Company. He's the author of Uneducated, a new memoir about navigating the professional white-collar world without that sheepskin. He's at fastcompany.com. Christopher, I'm going to pick up the memoir. Maybe we'll talk again after I read it, but thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate it. Have a nice day.
More business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A startup that's co-headquartered in Chicago has raised $15 million in funding. Leap helps e-commerce brands launch physical retail stores and has raised a total of $65 million since last year. The robust fundraising could signal a big change in the type of retail outlets that are found in prominent shopping areas. More than 50 brands use the Leap platform to power 100 stores in 11 different markets. One of those brands is Collars & Company, a men's fashion brand that recently opened its first brick-and-mortar store on Michigan Avenue. An analysis by Leap showed Collars & Company where its customers live, and Chicago was one of two places where those customers reside. Travelers who use Midway Airport in Chicago will have more food options in the coming months. Connie's Pizza and Emberger are opening locations in the airport later this summer and fall. There's also a White Sox Bar and Grill, Dunkin', Garrett Popcorn, and Beecher's Handmade Cheese. Those new and returning eateries are part of a modernization of Midway's food court, which has been closed since the spring. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and look who's here.
Hello, Steve.
It is a Mr. Fizz Friday. You doing okay, Jim Fizzell?
I'm good. It's a good day.
Yes, it is. You know, raising food and flowers can be hard sometimes, especially when it's been so dry, and we could all use a little support from time to time.
That's what I'm going to do, a little bit of support here and there.
Okay, we'll get to that after thanking the Chevy Silverado for supporting us. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Mr. Fizz.
You asked me if I'm going to talk about support today. Yes. Some kinds of the plants in the garden need support. Staking, caging, and tying up plants. Cages, these can be bought at the garden centers, but I prefer to make my own. This is made from concrete reinforcing wire. You can buy this in rolls. They're 5 feet wide and however long you want them. They have 6-inch squares in them. You need one 10-foot piece for every cage. So if you want to make 5 cages, buy 50 feet of this stuff, and you cut it off in 10-foot sections, leaving the end wire sticking out to where you cut it off next to the next cross wire. Then you cut these in half down the middle, taking the middle wire out. When you get done with that, you're going to have a thing that can be folded into a cylinder. They work beautifully. They don't wear out. It's amazing, and they do the job. Another thing you can use are stakes. Use 2x2s, 4 feet long or 6 feet long, depending on what kind of plants. You sharpen them and drive them into the ground next to the plant that you're trying to support, and then tie loosely with, I like to use strips of cloth, torn up T-shirts or something like that, to tie the plants. If you have a hurricane or cyclone fence next door, you can grow things right next to that fence, tie them up to it. Now, I had a neighbor years ago who used to use this exclusively for tying up, you won't believe this, watermelons. Neat little thing to do. Now, there are other things that you can do. You can install a fence in your garden, or you can put up trellises and so forth. There are no rules. Use your imagination and have a good time.
Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, from the farm to your belly. The calendar says it is National Detroit-Style Pizza Day. But I'm going to throw a challenge flag on that one.
And there's the red flag.
The red flag is down.
Yep.
Because this day was created in 2021 to celebrate the 75th anniversary of a pizza place in Detroit. So not really a national day, is it? I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Good day to play pickleball, I would say. You know, it's funny because I saw the headline the other day. It says Chicago has a new championship team. I thought, I don't think so. In fact, we do. It's the Chicago Slice. We talked to the owner of that team not that long ago. And here's the star player, Connor Garnett, who is a professional pickleball player. Connor, you're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, and you know, excited to be part of a rich Chicago sports history. So stoked that I was able to be a part of the Slice.
And this is the first season, right, for this professional pickleball league or play?
Yeah, they had a little bit of a season last year, but this is when it really took off. There have been a lot of cool celebrities getting involved in this, and there's been a ton of attention the last 6 months into pickleball, and one of the major initiatives was this Major League Pickleball team event.
So the Ricketts, Heidi Klum, other names that I might or might not recognize owned the team of four people, two men and two women. Do I recall that correctly that you're on?
Yeah, exactly. So it's awesome. We get two guys and two girls on the team, and we'll play a little bit of mixed doubles, which is the guy and the girl, and then gender doubles, and all get to play together and compete against other cities' teams as well.
So our team is this group of four people from around the country who are Chicago's representative. And then it was kind of a tour, right? You played in different cities across the country. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. So bringing kind of some of those local fans out to the different areas of the country, and there's going to be more events throughout the rest of the year to really start bringing that fan engagement to a pickleball like it is for other sports with those locations and cities.
Yeah, when does it come to Chicago? When can I watch a match here? Is that next season then that I'm anticipating?
I'm hoping. It's still in the works. They only have a few more this year, and so 2024, I believe they're going to be expanding a little more, and hopefully Chicago can pull one in after the good result we had this start of the year.
I got just a minute left, but tell me the match point, because as I understand it, this was a very close championship game, right?
Yeah, no, it was a battle. The team we were playing, the Breakers, they were up on us, and we came back to, it ended with singles, so with pickleball, we play a little doubles and singles, and it was hard fought. One of my teammates, Ryler, clutched the last point out, and we all ran on the court, and it was just a ton of emotions, amazing, amazing feeling, and brought Chicago a title.
Yeah. And then you got not only a trophy, but $50 million. Is that right?
You know, close. I think it was a lot less than that, but we definitely got some spending money and a lot of bragging rights going into the rest of the season.
You know how pickleball is all the rage now, and yet I haven't watched it played at the level that you're playing at. So I think a lot of us would like to eyeball that. Can I watch it on YouTube or ESPN4? Is there a way for us to watch what you do?
Yeah, so the PPA and Major League Pickleball are kind of the two main organizations that all compete in, and they're on YouTube, and they'll get on Tennis Channel a little bit. Amazon Prime has a few of the tournaments.
Huh.
I think ESPN, some of the lower ESPNs have a few too. So it's just getting started, and they're starting to go up the networks, but it's all over, and YouTube is a safe spot to start.
And we're off to a good start. The championship player from the Chicago Slice, Connor Garnett, professional pickleball player. I hope this isn't our last conversation, Connor. Congratulations to you and the team.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on and looking forward to hopefully chatting again.